Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Derek Gilman, the newly appointed director of the Barnes Foundation. Gilman's just written a book called The Idea of Cultural Heritage. Jason Pfeiffer examines the art, craft, and science of set design. Susan Lewis takes a look at the world of fine art photography. And in our regular exploration of the Culture File section at gophila.com, we visit historic Falsington. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
After a year-long search, the Barnes Foundation has appointed a new president. He's Derek Gilman, who's been in charge of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts since 1999. He has previously held senior positions at high-profile art schools and museums in England and Australia, and besides being a highly experienced art school and museum director, has also been involved with the construction or renovation of several major buildings, most recently the new extension to the Pennsylvania Academy. Gilman will oversee the design and construction of a new home for the Barnes on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway in Philadelphia. The controversial move of the Barnes' priceless art collection from its Lower Merion home to this new gallery is still the subject of much debate in the city. This is just one of the challenges Gilman acknowledges he will face in his new position. Another is to remain true to the principles of Albert Barnes and the Foundation's original Director of Education, John Dewey, whose teaching methods are still used today. Derek Gilman has recently completed a book titled The Idea of Cultural Heritage. In it, he discusses how certain iconic works of art have come to be seen not as belonging to individuals, but of intrinsic value to entire communities and even nations. I spoke with Derek Gilman earlier this week and first asked him about his decision to take up the helm at the Barnes.
I didn't think long about whether I wanted the job, insofar as when I was approached, it was flattering to be approached, and I know the collection, and it's the most tremendous collection, and I knew the programs as well. And what I thought about most, I think, was not so much the desirability of working with that collection, but whether I would be able to contribute to the educational programming and to the whole vision in a way that would justify what Barnes had wanted and what Dewey had wanted. And I felt, after reflection, that I could. But that did require thought, because it's a very complex, maybe complex is the wrong word, but it's a very ambitious agenda. I think anybody taking it on had to be willing to work with that agenda. And in my case, I wanted not just to work with it and continue it as it had evolved over the last decades, but also go back and see how I could make it relevant for the 21st century.
But it is complex. You're talking about a collection with restrictions on it. You're talking about a teaching philosophy that's somewhat out of the mainstream. I think it's fair to say that the kind of teaching philosophies that you had at the Academy would be somewhat different from the teaching methods of Barnes and Dewey.
Yeah, I think there were two sides to that. One is the philosophy per se, and Dewey was the philosopher. And then there's the aesthetic theories. And I think the aesthetic theories, although they were evolved to build on the original philosophical ambition, you know, were different and very particular to that period, and very, very ambitious, which was to use the collection in a way which would create a more inclusive and democratic society, because that's what Dewey was about. It was all about emphasizing the fact that America was the great experiment, and unlike the old countries of Europe, it was the place where you could really see what democracy could do, and it was a very, very optimistic philosophy.
And that was exemplified by Dewey. How successful was this philosophy? How much did it live and breathe through the Barnes over the last 50, 60 years, do you think?
I think the bit of Dewey which continued was the part where he worked with Barnes on an aesthetic philosophy, which was more to do with how you looked at art and used art to generate a richer and deeper life. So that was the more practical side, and it's that side of the Dewey philosophy which carried on and turned into the Barnes methods that we know now.
We'd actually scheduled this interview sometime before you were appointed president of Barnes to talk about a book that you've written, which is soon to be published, called The Idea of Cultural Heritage. It could be subtitled Who Owns Art? You do cover a couple of Philadelphia landmark cases, the Dream Garden and the Sam Eric Theatre in the book. No mention of the Barnes.
No, I didn't write about the Barnes. I felt that this book had its genesis long before I came to Philadelphia. I started thinking about this subject way back. And the Barnes was a complicated case, which I became, you know, very much aware of. But I also knew there was a lot written about it. And the other cases, although there was a lot written about them, I felt that I could approach them with a degree of freshness with respect to questions I was asking. One of the thrusts of the book is that there are two ways, there have become two ways of thinking about cultural heritage or cultural property. On the one hand, those who say it belongs to all of us and those who say it belongs to some of us.
Hmm. Where do you fall down on that? I mean, for instance, you don't believe that, for instance, the Elgin marbles should be returned to Greece.
No, I don't. At the Academy, I have a wonderful Greek conservator, and we debate this happily and agree to differ in a very civilized way.
So why not? Why not? I mean, the Greek claim would be this is an intricate part of our cultural heritage. It's a part of the Parthenon. This great wonder of the world is incomplete because these statues are in a British museum, British Museum.
And
seems like a fairly reasoned argument to me.
Yes, it does. I mean, actually, both sides of the debate can seem extremely reasoned and can be extremely reasoned, and that's what makes it so interesting. The whole book is probably about how to answer that question. So
answer that question just on that point. Why do the Elgin marbles belong to the British Museum rather than to the Greek people?
I make the case that the Greek government's case is not strong enough to justify return.
Legally or morally?
Morally. I think probably if it did come to court, and it would come to court in Britain, a court would be unlikely to agree to the Greeks' claim.
So that's the legal side.
That's the legal side.
Morally, you say morally.
I'm much more, and the book is about the moral side, because I say that you know, if you can put the legal side, you know, if you can get that out of the way, there remain these moral arguments. And it's the moral arguments which are the interesting ones, because you've got a claim, which is that to take a particular extremely valuable piece of art or collection of art and return it without compensation somewhere else, but not on legal grounds. Well, that's an unusual claim, because in our lives, in our general lives, we very rarely encounter something like that. It's unusual. When you contest a piece of property, it either settled in court or it settled out of court. But there's not a lot which is left over which says, well, whether we settle it in court or out of court, there's still an argument I should have it. And that's the case with these restitution claims, that they're a moral argument.
When the discussion of the moving of the Barnes Foundation became somewhat controversial, you were very clear about what you felt was the right thing, that it should move to the Benjamin Franklin Parkway.
Yeah, I felt that was really the right thing to happen. And I did so because I think there are really two ways of thinking about Dr. Barnes. There was the Barnes of the Albert Barnes at the beginning, and there's the Albert Barnes at the end after decades of sparring with Philadelphians. But I think there's another, going back to the, you know, where we started, there was another Barnes at the beginning with Dewey, who had this very, very, very ambitious, open, optimistic vision about what the institution could do. And from my point of view, I think I'm always willing to be proven wrong. But the truth is, I think that Albert Barnes was a very complex and immensely ambitious person. And to read him only in terms of those long years of being disillusioned with people in Philadelphia is unfair to him. Because I think at heart he was an enormous visionary. And that's the Albert Barnes that I want to recover. And so although, you know, it may be true that if you read him only in terms of the end of the last decades of his life, you do get that take on him. I don't think that's the Albert Barnes we want to really remember for the future. I think we want to remember the Albert Barnes who was absolutely dedicated to serving the American people.
The new president of the Barnes Foundation, Derek Gilman, speaking with me earlier this week. His soon-to-be-published book is called The Idea of Culture. He takes charge of the Barnes in mid-October. If you spend enough time in a theatrical environment, sooner or later you're bound to hear the art form described as a collaborative effort. Mounting a full-scale theatrical production takes more than just a script, actors, and a director. It also takes the collaboration of administrators, a production staff, and designers. This week, Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer takes a look at one important component of this team, the set designer, and explores the demands of the job.
While actors are largely responsible for telling the story of a play, what helps transport audience members into the imaginary world is the environment created on stage. Before pieces of scenery are constructed and installed, however, the world of the play needs to be planned out in great detail. This is a crucial part of a set designer's work. Dan Boylan has designed extensively in regional shows, including productions by Pennsylvania Ballet and the McCarter Theater. As professor of scene and lighting design, he has taught at Temple University since 1968 and is presently chair of the school's theater department. Boylan's criteria for what constitutes a good set designer sets the bar high.
Knows everything about everything. It's knowing as much as you possibly can about civilization, about humanity, about all of the other arts. Because theater is something that brings, and certainly the scene design aspect of it, brings all of the other arts together in one thing. There's sculpture, there's painting. And so the more you know, it seems to me, about what is happening in all of the different fields of the arts, you can bring it to bear on theater because we use all of those things.
According to Boylan, in some ways it's helpful to think of a set designer as an architect. Both roles are conceptual in nature and typically share a process that starts out with sketches and drawings, later blueprints, then detailed models, all before any construction takes place. Determining how to design the environment for any one play is contingent on a variety of factors, such as the story's context and the director's vision for the production. But Dan Boylan says these aren't necessarily his primary concerns.
I'm firmly committed to an idea that the designer is in service to principally the actor. You're creating a world for the actor. You're creating an environment, one that, of course, supports the play and supports, you know, what the director is trying to do. But it's you want the actor to know that he is in this other place.
The staging of a play, of course, does not always take place in a conventional location, which can make designing some sets rather tricky. Matt Saunders, who in addition to being a local actor, is a Philadelphia-based set designer that's worked with companies like the Walnut Street Theater, the Arden Theater, the Pig Iron Theater Company, and New Paradise Laboratories.
A lot of my work is site-specific, which means that it's not necessarily in a theater. It could be in a warehouse, a church, a hotel swimming pool. So these sites are very unique. So in terms of who do I serve, a lot of times it's the space. Then my job is sort of, I need to respect the space. I have to serve the space. I can't, you know, impose too much on it. I can't, like, muscle my design mind in there and put a bunch of stuff in there. And so then it became, like, a very delicate sort of dialogue between me and the space and how to strike a sort of harmony there.
Striking this harmony with the other components of a production is a common theme among set designers. Dan Boylan explains that while some set designs do call for attention-grabbing elements, for instance, productions like Cirque du Soleil and large-scale operas, most do not seek to divert the focus of the audience.
I call it designer greed, because a scenic designer, lighting designer, can blow anything off the stage, I mean, in terms of an actor. You can become so much more the dominant visual element that's going on. And, of course, this is totally wrong.
In the United States, most professional scenic designers are freelancers who jump from project to project, theater to theater, much like actors do. Most designers also go through a formal education in learning their craft. Megan Jones is a third-year Master of Fine Arts student in scenic design at Temple University. As she finishes her studies this year, she notes one of the primary lessons of her schooling.
Learning how to communicate with your other designers and learning how to communicate with the rest of the production team and learning how to listen to people.
This emphasis on good communication skills is echoed by Matt Saunders.
Each project is so, so different. And, you know, I think the most important thing is being able to collaborate with a director. You know, that seems to be the biggest variable from project to project is, you know, who the director is, what the vision for the piece is, and what the request of the piece is. And being able to, you know, sort of step up to that challenge and give and take sort of creative focus.
As the projects of scene designers vary, so also do the budgets, ranging from a few thousand to a few $100,000. While Matt Saunders doesn't have a preference for small budgets, he admits the limitations can make the design process more productive.
It's this whole notion of restricting the palette. fine art painters talk about it a lot. It's like if you restrict the palette, so to speak, and you take a few colors out, or you take a few brushes out, then that's where creativity happens, because the definition of creativity is a unique approach to a problem. So if you don't really have the problem, it's harder to be creative. It's frustrating, don't get me wrong. I would love to have all the money in the world, but it is productive, I think.
Regardless of how much creativity a certain set design might demonstrate, or if it stayed within a budget, the true test of a scenic design's success cannot be gauged by merely looking at it, out of the context of an actual performance that includes the elements of lighting, sound design, costumes, actors, and an audience. As Dan Boylan notes, it is only on opening night that a set designer's job is done. Never before.
WRTI's theater reporter Jason Pfeiffer. Photography is now an accepted part of the art scene, even at traditional bastions of classical art forms. But did photographs always garner art world respect? Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis explores the history of fine art photography and asks what makes these photographs art, while most of our snaps are at best just pretty pictures.
At some point in our lives, most of us have had a camera of sorts, an easy Instamatic, a fancy SLR, or something in between. We pull them out for baby pictures, birthday parties, holidays, reunions, and automatically toss them into our vacation bags for memories of the beach or historic sites, or perhaps for those ubiquitous sightings of the tops of clouds out of airplane windows. Today, we could take digital shots and even play around with the images on our computers before we print them out ourselves. But still, how many of us consider ourselves real photographers? The word photograph comes from the Greek words for light and writing. But what makes a photograph art? Does it depend on the intent of the photographer? What it's used for? Or just how cool the final image looks? When do our pictures match the quality you'd see in a magazine or newspaper, let alone the artistry you'd find on a museum gallery wall? Peter Barberry, curatorial fellow in photography at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, says there's no clean answer as to what's art and what's not.
I have never known anybody that could define art in a way that nailed it down perfectly and that satisfied me. The rules for what art is change over time and through history.
Louise Krasnowitz, senior research scientist at the University of Pennsylvania's Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, agrees.
Why do we call one art and one not art? That says a lot more about us than it does about the images themselves.
When photographs were invented, they were put to practical and aesthetic uses. French theater owner Louis Daguerre and English scientist Henry Fox Talbot each produced a successful photograph around 1839. And photographs were soon used for everything from botanical studies and cityscapes to portraits. But the art world's reaction to photography was mixed, says Barberry.
The art world first was amazed and delighted, and then quickly very worried. And you get certain factions of the art world throughout the 19th century resisting photography and attacking it. Printmakers realized that a lot of the tasks that prints were used for were going to be usurped by photography. It was commonly a cliche in the 19th century that photography would replace painting.
Instead, photography grew into its own form of expression as a way to document reality, express ideas, and perhaps most significantly, produce images on a scale never before seen.
And it really has changed the nature of visual experience. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of prints in the world in the 19th century and thousands of paintings, but within a matter of 10 years, there were millions of photographs.
Millions of photographs. And photographers whose numbers increased exponentially with George Eastman's 1888 invention of a box camera for popular use, then again in the early 1920s with the introduction of the handheld camera. And photography went in as many directions as those who tried it. In the late 19th century art world, there were the pictorialists who sought to distinguish themselves as artists by adding unique features, printing on fine paper, signing their photographs with monograms, or framing them beautifully. They chose subjects like those of the symbolist and impressionist painters of the 19th century, says Barberry.
Beautiful women in beautiful settings, children, lots of very moody landscapes at certain times of day, sunset or sunrise, things like that.
Beyond the art world, ordinary people began using handheld cameras to document family life as we do today. And working somewhere in between documentation and pure aesthetic was the illustrated magazine world, populated by the likes of Life, Time, and National Geographic. Current consumer-friendly digital technology may blur the line even further between personal and art photography. Although, as the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Peter Barberry points out, This digital method is a whole different process, about which there is some debate in the art world.
For a lot of art historians like myself, what is really special about photography is that it's a silver-based medium. It's an image made by light thrown onto certain objects in the world, whereas digital photography is made through the technology of computers and the digital camera, and it relies on computer programs. It's much closer, in my opinion, to earlier picture-making forms like printmaking or drawing or painting. But most photographers I talk to are not that worried about this distinction. They think the digital processes simply allow them to do what they care about doing in photography even better.
It's clear that photography, using film, digital processing, or some newly evolving technology, has taken its place alongside other media in the art world, and we can see shows of different types in all sorts of venues. So about this question of photography as art, maybe it's for each of us to decide. In the end, art may be whatever image moves you or changes the way you feel about your world, whether it's the work of a stranger in a museum gallery or a picture that evokes a cherished memory hanging in your own home.
Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis. Now in our regular dip into the Culture File section at gophila.com, we take a trip to historic Faultington. It was a time of big-finned cars, TV dinners, and the baby boom, the 1950s in America. The breeding ground for much of this was the new American suburb. The suburbs changed not just the families and the fads, but also the landscape of the country, starting with two Levitt towns, the first in Long Island, New York, and after its success, another in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. The shrewd developer of these two planned communities, William Levitt, is often credited with being the creator of the American suburb. For many people, the idea of rows of nearly identical compact homes represented the American dream. For others, it was a nightmare.
And the small village atmosphere of Faultington was being threatened by all this new housing and building development, new roads, new schools. The infrastructure was totally changing all around it.
The story sounds like the beginning of a fairy tale, as Erica Armour, executive director of Historic Faultington, tells it. The people in the peaceful village living in their small hand-built houses until one day their happy existence was threatened by an ominous intruder. The scariest part about this story is the way it multiplied. In 1952, after plans for a new U.S. steel mill in the area were announced, the construction of Levittown, Pennsylvania began, and in the next 6 years, over 17,000 houses were built. With each requiring a down payment of just $100, the houses were occupied immediately. Just 3 miles away, the village of Faultington had a slower growth. First settled by English Quaker farmers in the 1600s, the town was a picturesque example of colonial America. William Penn's country estate, Pensbury Manor, was down the road, and Penn himself often worshipped in a Quaker meeting house in Faultington. Change in the village was gradual. One Quaker meeting house gave route to two more, all three still at the same intersection today. It was what was happening to the area surrounding Faultington that alarmed residents of this quiet village, some of whom could trace their roots back to the first settlers. Concerns mounted when a 19th century stone house went up for sale, as Erica Armour explains.
There was folklore and stories running wild that this building would be purchased and torn down to provide space for a gas station, which is a classic Bucks County story.
As Armour is quick to admit, the bucolic farms had already become a thing of the past.
Now we grow houses opposed to being once dairy farmers, wheat farmers, and truck farming. We now grow houses in Bucks, Montgomery, and Chester.
To make sure they didn't become part of this story, the residents of Faultington bought this house and created a non-profit organization with a mission to preserve the town and use it as a teaching tool for future generations. Since this first purchase, Historical Faultington Incorporated has purchased two more buildings and is now named on the National Registry of Historic Places, protecting it from future development. The Burgess Lippincott Mansion, as the first house purchased is called, demonstrates, among other things, how our ideas about house sizes have changed in 200 years. The Federal-style stone building is about the same size as a modest home in Levittown. The house is open for tours and is set up for 19th-century living. Faultington, with its narrow streets and modest houses, feels like a rural village, although big-box shopping malls loom just minutes away. Erica Armour points to what looks like a large log cabin.
We're right now at the Moon Williamson Log House, which is still standing on its original site and was built in the 1760s. We interpret colonial life through this. We talk about how the settlers came into the area, the hardships they faced, the primitive lifestyles. We can go inside right now.
After a tour of the cold and dark, and all things considered, rather cute house, visitors can wander around the village where there are over 90 historic homes. Peeking in these windows, however, is not appreciated. Unlike other historic sites, there are real people living in these houses in this still active town. Visitors can stop in the Stagecoach Tavern, built in 1790. The preserved tavern is a reminder that public houses were once there for more than just a cold pint, as Erica Armour explains.
Out here in the country, a tavern is more of an inn. It's very interchangeable at that point in time. Because we are farmers in this area, we need a place to rest, water our livestock, maybe get wagon wheels repaired, get something to eat ourselves, back and forth between Morrisville, Trenton, and Philadelphia. So a tavern makes sense for the community. In a tavern like this, the tavern keeper would have served homemade beer or hard cider, which was very prevalent during that time. Water was always suspect. So hard cider was a beverage of choice. Children drank hard cider. It was not unusual. A smart tavern keeper would actually have newspapers dropped off, and he would act as the local postmaster, which indeed this tavern keeper did. So people would come here on a daily basis to pick up their letters, their news, their correspondence, and then exchange news.
With the dining area set up for tea and the yellowed newspapers on the coffee table, it almost feels as if William Penn himself will walk through the door with the news of the day. And the sounds of modern life notwithstanding, if William Penn did show up, he'd probably still feel rather comfortable here. More information on historic Falsington is available at the Culture Files section of gofilla.com. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Theresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Pam Costi, Megan Smedley and Dominic Mercier. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.